Have you got a favourite motivational quote or slogan? Something that really fires you up for life and for life's challenges? I've got a selection here. What do you think of this one? Once you become fearless, life becomes limitless. That's anonymous. Glory gives herself only to those who have always dreamed of her. Charles de Gaulle. There's another one. The dangers of life are infinite, and among them is safety. That's the famous Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Never heard of him. Not to say it isn't true, what he says. Greatness lives on the edge of destruction. It's Will Smith. Not sure which Will Smith. If it's the actor, well. The most dangerous moment comes with victory. That's Napoleon Bonaparte. In 1955, Major General Frederick C. Bless of the US Air Force wrote a fighter tactics manual, considered the Bible of air-to-air combat, entitled No Guts, No Glory. Pretty good. That was quoted by the famous philosopher Ian Wright on the build-up to the FA Cup final this past season. But if you could sum up the mindset of Jesus Christ during his three-year mission on earth, I suggest it could be no death, no glory. No death, no glory. And that's the title of our message tonight. You can have a subheading, if you like, of The Surprising Path to Spiritual Success. So with that in mind, let's turn back in our Bibles to the Gospel of John, to the reading that we had earlier. And in particular, I want us to consider verse 24. Where Jesus says, truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. So our purpose tonight is to understand this verse. What it meant for Jesus, what it means for us. And in order to do that, we're going to consider it under three headings. The first is the context. The second, the meaning of this verse, and then thirdly and lastly, the challenge of this verse. So, point number one, the context. Two very significant things are happening in the background, if you like, and the foreground of Jesus's life at this time. Firstly, Jesus's popularity is reaching fever pitch. Look at verse 9. When the large crowd of the Jews learned that Jesus was there, they came, not only on account of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. I think I'd probably go and see somebody that had been raised from the dead. That's quite an impressive thing. He's become a bit of a local celebrity as our Lazarus. So people are flocking to see Jesus and also to see Lazarus. And then verses 12 to 15. The next day, the large crowd that had come to the feast heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. This is the famous triumphal entry. So they took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him, crying out, Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel. And Jesus found a young donkey and sat on it, just as it is written, Fear not, daughter of Zion, behold, your king is coming, sitting on a donkey's colt. And then verse 19. The exasperated Pharisees said to one another, You see that you are gaining nothing? Look, the world has gone after him. These people are his enemies. So Jesus' popularity is reaching fever pitch. Huge crowds are amassing to see him. And simultaneously, the Jewish ruling elite have decided that Jesus must die. They've had enough. The time has come to plot the death of Jesus Christ. Look at chapter 11 of the Gospel of John, verses 45 to 50. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, "What are we to do? For this man, Jesus, performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all. Nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." And then verse 53. "So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death." And verse 57. "Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know, so that they might arrest him." These days in police jargon, we'd say he's been circulated as wanted. If anyone was going to see Jesus, they must tell the rulers, the Pharisees, and they will arrest him. And they'll take it from there. But there's a warrant out for his arrest. So that's the backdrop. Incredible popularity, and yet this plot to kill Jesus. And in verses 20 and 21 of chapter 12, we see that Jesus's popularity is spread beyond national boundaries, so that even the non-Jews, the Gentiles, want an audience with the king elect. Look there in verse 20 and 21. "Now among those who went up to worship at the feast were some Greeks. So these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee." He may have been a familiar face. May have been from his region, their region. They may have thought, "Ah, here we go. Somebody who lives amongst Gentiles. He may be able to introduce us, get us an audience with Jesus." So they go to Philip from Bethsaida in Galilee and asked him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Philip went and told Andrew. Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. But this visit appears to be a pivotal moment, a tipping point in the life of Jesus, when you look at his reaction to their request in verse 23. "And Jesus answered them, 'The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified.'" It's an interesting answer, isn't it, when you think about it? These Greeks, who are no doubt Gentiles, non-Jews that have converted to Judaism, are coming to see Jesus. What's the significance of that? Why would that be a pivotal moment in the life of Christ and in the history of the Messiah? You see, this seemingly incidental request actually represented another fulfillment of messianic prophecy. Back in the book of Isaiah, the prophecy of Isaiah, chapter 11 and verse 10, we read, and this is all pointing forward to when the Messiah would come, "In that day, the root of Jesse," another way of saying the son of David, "who shall stand as a signal for the peoples. Of him shall the nations inquire, and his resting place will be glorious." So actually, what Jesus sees when these Gentiles, people from other nations, are coming to him, is yet another fulfillment of prophecy. The Jews and the Gentiles were looking to Jesus to be their king, their Messiah. And surely now, the time is ripe for his coronation. But whilst Jesus agrees that now is the time for him to be glorified, verse 23, that glory was not going to be achieved by his now being proclaimed king, but by a very different and an unexpected pathway, which is why Jesus' reply in verse 24 is so surprising. Look at it again. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Intriguing. An intriguing answer. So we've looked at the context. Now we're going to look at the meaning of verse 24. So it's time for some biblical maths and audience participation. Okay, you ready for this? 1 plus naught equals... Sure? Very good. Very good. 100% so far. 1 plus naught equals 1. I'm glad you agreed with me on that because maths is not my strong point. All right, what about this one? 1 minus 1. Hold that thought. We're going to turn to Revelation chapter 7 for the answer. Last book of the Bible. Revelation chapter 7. Verses 9 and 10. The mystery will become clear as we go through this. Biblical maths. Okay. What do we see? Verse 9 and 10. After this, I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number. From every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." And then verses 13 and 14. Then one of the elders addressed me, saying, "Who are these clothed in white robes, and from where have they come?" I said to him, "Sir, you know." And he said to me, "These are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." Did you notice what they were holding in verse 9? Palm branches. Haven't we just read that in John 12? The triumphal entry? But also, what were they wearing? Verses 9 and 14. White robes. What have those robes been washed in? Verse 14, the blood of the Lamb. In other words, what we're seeing in this vision in the book of Revelation is a post-crucifixion version of the triumphal entry on a monumental scale. That's what's happening. No death of Jesus, no crucifixion, there will be an empty heaven. There won't be anybody there, apart from Jesus, God, his angels. But in terms of humanity, not a single soul will be in heaven unless Jesus dies. No death, empty heaven. But with the death of Jesus, how many were there in verse 9? A multitude which no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands and crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." A full heaven. You can't count the number of believers that there will be in glory on account of the death of Christ. 1 plus naught equals 1. If Jesus doesn't die, he remains a single grain of wheat. That's what he's saying. I just remain alone. My life is fruitless. I achieve nothing. Heaven will be empty. 1 minus 1, if Jesus lays down his life voluntarily, suffering on behalf of his people, more people than you can possibly count will be in heaven. A phenomenal harvest from that one grain of wheat falling into the ground. So Jesus knows that he must die in order for that great triumphal entry scene on a huge, colossal scale to come to pass in glory. He knew that the people that were actually crying out to him in John 12, many of them, as we sang in our hymn a moment ago, after crying out hosannas to him, they'd be crying out, crucify. Crucify him. Within a very short period of time, but in glory, in heaven, because he dies for his people. True worship, pure worship. Everybody that is there loves Jesus. They're going to be with him forever and ever, praising him, worshipping him in glory. But he knows he has to die. And that doesn't mean simply because he knows it's going to happen and that it's prophesied that it's going to happen, that it's going to be easy for him. It fills him with dread. Look at verse 27, going back to John chapter 12. Verse 27, now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. He's determined to do the will of his Father. Glorify your name. I know this is going to cost me everything. I know this is going to put me through pain that no other person will ever experience, could ever experience. I know that there would be an easy way out for me simply by not going to the cross. But Father, I want to do your will. I want to obey you. I want to fulfill the plan that we purposed in eternity so that I would come on behalf of all my people and suffer on the cross for them, to take the punishment that they deserve. I want to take it, Lord, so that they can be set free, so that they don't have to suffer the punishment of hell. I'm willing to go to the cross. I'm willing to take hell on their behalf. Father, glorify your name. And his Father affirms him, doesn't he? In verse 28. He says, Father, glorify your name. Then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it and I will glorify it again. Jesus' death will be the ultimate triumph over the devil and the most comprehensive response to his temptation. Surely at this point, perhaps more than ever, the temptation that the devil gave to Jesus was more real to him than ever before. Let's just have a look at that. What was on the table from the devil? Matthew chapter 4. Don't have to turn to it if you don't wish, but I will read it to you. Matthew chapter 4, verses 8 and 10. Do you remember this when Jesus was tempted? Right back at the beginning of his ministry. Again, the devil took him up to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these I will give you if you fall down and worship me. It's quite an offer. As we read, as we've already read, and we'll read again in a moment, the devil is described as the ruler of this world. In a sense, he could give those nations to Jesus. He could have had them without having to go to the cross. But in order to do that, he would have to bow the knee to the devil, which he would never do. Jesus said to him, verse 10, "Begone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you shall serve." Then the devil left him. Only, I'm sure, to seem very present again at this particular moment in Jesus' life. Glory would come to him, salvation and glory would come to his people, only if he went to the cross. Not if he gave in to the crowds, not if he was just a crowd pleaser. Can you imagine that, being surrounded by thousands upon thousands of people, calling out praises to your name, wanting to make you king over them, thinking this could be the start of a global kingdom, destroying the enemies of Israel, replacing Roman rule with the rule of Jesus, and that would carry on. His rule would extend across the world. He could do it now, couldn't he, without the cross? Satan whispers in his ear a reminder of the temptation. You can still have it. All these nations, the Gentiles are even coming to see you now, aren't they? You can have it. You don't have to go the way of pain. You don't have to go the way of suffering. No death, no glory. Jesus knew that. So we looked at the context of verse 24. We've looked at the meaning. Now let's consider the challenge of not just that verse, but the verses immediately that follow, verses 26 and 27. Let's read from verse 24. "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." And here comes the challenge to us. Whoever loves his life loses it. And whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there will my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. If no death meant no glory for Jesus, the same applies to us. Jesus looks at his own death and sees that as the pathway to glory. He looks forward to heaven, where he will be, and his followers will be. And there will be a vast number of them. No death, no glory. For us, if we want to be part of that picture in Revelation, praising God, being with Jesus forever, we too have to take up our cross. We have to die. But what does that mean? It's another mysterious phrase or saying. You've got to die to yourself. Well, what is that doing? That's not encouraging suicide, is it? No. We can't replicate the death of Christ. Nothing. Our death could not achieve anything in terms of taking away our sin. That was a unique, one-off historical event. Jesus is the only one, because he's the pure Lamb of God who can take away the sin of the world. But Jesus says, if you're going to be with me where I am, you have to follow me. And that's going to mean death to self. Death to selfishness. A denial of self as opposed to self-denial. He's not saying if you want to get to heaven, what you've got to do is give up chocolate for Lent. You know, just deprive yourself of something that you enjoy. Make yourself feel bad for a few weeks in the year, and that will be enough. It's not what he's talking about. Death to self is far more profound. There's another passage I'll read to you now in Luke's Gospel, chapter 9. Verses 22 to 26, where Jesus says these words. And he said to all, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels." What is your life? What does life mean to you? What do you want to get out of life? What hopes and ambitions do you have? What do you want to be? Where do you see yourself in 5 years' time? What sort of salary are you going to be drawing down in 10 years' time? What are your plans? What are your hopes? What are your aspirations? What house will you live in? What region of the country will you live in? Will you be able to move into a posh area, have a really expensive house? Will you rise up the ladder? Will you get promoted time after time? Will you head up a company or be somebody really significant in your profession? If you achieve everything that you set out to achieve in life, and you pursue your dream as if that's all that matters in this life, you will lose your life, your soul, for eternity. And then what profit to you was it that you had seemingly the world at your feet? At least your world. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world, fulfills all his dreams and wishes, and seems to have everything that the world wants, and forfeits his soul so that eternity is spent in hell, suffering for the sins that you have committed? No death to self and to selfishness, to living for number one, for putting your will above God's will, no glory. Let's just think about our decision making for a moment. What is uppermost in your thinking when you think about your life and what you will do and how you will live it? What your priorities will be? What life choices you make, the things that you do, things that you're willing to experience. What's uppermost in your thinking? What you want out of it? The pleasure, the fun, the entertainment? Or do you think, what does God want me to do? What does his word tell me? What do his commandments require of me? When you weigh those two things up, which wins? Your will or God's will? You see, fundamentally, as human beings, we choose what we want. We are selfish beings. We do what pleases us. We put self, ourselves, on the throne of our lives. And Jesus is saying to us, if you want to follow me and be with me in glory, and be amongst that vast crowd, you've got to put yourself to death. Not just once, but every single day of your life. Somebody may think, well, I think I've become a Christian. Once in the past, I said a prayer to God and asked him to forgive me and make me a Christian. What is your life like now? What is your life like every day? Are you dying to self every day? Is God's will priority in your life? Or are you living for yourself? If you want to be in glory with Jesus amongst that vast crowd, you have to die now. Die to self. Die daily. If anybody wants to be with me, if anyone wants to follow me, they have to take up their cross every single day. So, what will we do? We will say to ourselves one of two things. For me to become a Christian, there is too much to lose. It's too much to lose. I've invested too much in this life, in my life. I've got too many plans, too many things I want to achieve that don't involve God and don't involve Jesus and don't involve Christianity and don't involve church going and don't involve following Jesus and obeying his commandments. There's too much to lose if I become a Christian. So you keep your life, you hold on to it tightly, as if that's going to give you everything you wanted it to give you. And yet you'll lose it forever. Too much to lose. Or you'll say to yourself, there's too much to gain not to become a Christian. I'm done with my life. I'm done with my selfishness. I've done with me on the throne. I want Jesus to take over my life. I want him to be Lord. I want him to be my saviour. I want his death, when he died upon the cross, to be the death that I should have died. I want him to take the punishment for me. I want to follow him to where he's going. To glory. To heaven. To be with him and his people forever. I want that. I'm prepared to do anything to be there. And Jesus simply says, believe in me. Trust in me. Follow me. Give up your life. Put me on the throne. And you'll be with me. Too much to lose? Or too much to gain? No death. No glory. What will you choose?